We are Black Food Folks.
We are Black Food Folks.
Welcome back to Black Desserts. I'm your host, Therese Nelson. One of the reasons I've loved crafting this series is because desserts give us a visceral vehicle to talk about so many ideas around family, nostalgia, and memory. One of the things I wanted to explore ever since my conversation last season with Paola Velez was around the long history of community building and activism that has been a hallmark of Black baking traditions for generations. From enslaved cooks finding agency and income through their baking talents to women like Georgia Gilmore supporting the civil rights movement financially and spiritually, baking has always been a powerful gateway to social movement. This is a quick housekeeping note about sound quality before you enjoy this episode. We record this series remotely, and our guests are coming to you from all over the globe. The conversations are so dope, and our guests drop so many gorgeous pearls throughout the season, so I hope that you're able to extend us a little grace and adjust into slight variances in sound quality throughout the series. I also hope that you love this season as much as I've loved hosting it. On this episode, we're leaning into this theme by talking with two amazing women who have built their businesses during the early days of the pandemic and have found new purpose through mission-based entrepreneurship. We begin in Atlanta, where I talk with Chef Colette Knight, owner of the specialty food brand Good Good Pudding.
My name is Colette Knight, and I own Good Good Pudding and Good Good Foods. We are focused right now on our bread pudding, which I have been making for many years, and it's an award-winning bread pudding. So we are a bread pudding and dessert sauce company.
Colette is an absolute superstar who has been a chef for over 30 years with a career that has spanned every area in food service. But she attributes much of her success to her early experiences helping her family build their restaurant business. So talk to me a little bit about, you say, award-winning and a recipe that you've had for a long time. Talk to me a little bit about your early career, early training, and especially you working with your family.
Yeah, sure. I'm originally from Los Angeles. I'm born and bred in Los Angeles, California. My father had a career in the 60s in Hollywood. He was an executive for Screen Actors Guild and 20th Century Fox. He was an arbitrator. He negotiated contracts to make sure that Blacks got fair wages in the industry and that had access to careers within the industry in the 60s. And in his second career, he decided to go into the restaurant business. My entire family cooks. I come from a long line of good Southern cooks. My mother's from Little Rock, Arkansas. My father's from Mobile, Alabama. Everything was centered around food and the kitchen. I've been in the kitchen my entire life. So his second career, he decided to get into food, which led him to fast food, which McDonald's franchisee. So my first real job was at McDonald's. And at that time, we actually made the biscuits from scratch. We made buttermilk biscuits every morning. That is correct. They weren't punched out. At that time, they were from scratch. And I always had what we call pastry hands. So my job at McDonald's, aside from managing, I would make the biscuits every morning and I made salads. And I have another uncle that became a Taco Bell franchisee and another one that became a Burger King franchisee. I've worked all of those businesses. That led me to culinary. I realized I really love food. I love the business of food and I love serving people and feeding people. I was our hostess at McDonald's. My mother was truly unique. Because she was from the South, my mother added grits to the You couldn't even have grits, okay? But she did. She had a crock pot, and because she knew our clientele here in Atlanta, we served grits on the weekend with our breakfast, and my mother made me go around and pour coffee to every customer, giving refills. She put tablecloths on the tables and flowers on the tables. She truly understood hospitality, hostessing. She did study home economics in college, and that's what it was called at that time, but we know it's hospitality, which is what I ended up studying years later, hospitality administration and culinary arts.
Family is a powerful and recurring theme in Colette's story. And during our conversation, she came back quite a bit to her parents and the lessons they taught her. It was obvious how impacted she's been by their legacy, and it was a profound honor to have her share them with me so generously. She's still unpacking their passing and is using their lessons to inform this new era of her career. So I wanted to make sure that we took a moment to make space for her to honor their memories during the episode.
Yes, let's honor Holy Layfoot Knight, a country boy from Alabama that moved to Los Angeles and made it well, and then consequently met and married Emma Joyner Knight. And they had three children, and then they ended up moving from California to Atlanta, doing real estate and food business. And yeah, so I honored them today. I was with both of them till their last breath. I was their caregiver, and my father passed in January 2000. His last words were, "Colette, the love of my life." He opened his eyes, and that's what he said. And he closed his eyes and he transitioned. My mother's last words, and I was with her, and I didn't sleep for 48 hours, her last 48 hours before I called hospice. She said, "Colette, you're the best thing I ever did." And these were gifts that you can't make this stuff up. And so I don't regret not any part of my journey. And from there, I worked in fine dining, front of the house, back of the house. But I always had an affinity for baking. I love chemistry and science, and so that's why I gravitated towards that. And years later, I became a culinary educator, and I taught at the Kitchen Academy of Hollywood. Of course, I taught baking and pastry and garde manger. And I still love both of those. That program, I actually wrote the second edition baking and pastry program. And when the company sold, it became Le Cordon Bleu. So it was the accelerated program of Le Cordon Bleu in Hollywood.
There's so many themes that keep recurring in your story that I find particularly fascinating. One is the sort of lineage of entrepreneurship, but also hospitality entrepreneurship in your family. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that heirloom of service, the way in which you saw the framing of the professional hospitality space model coming up and how it's infused into how you do business.
My parents were ahead of their time. My parents believed in excellence. They believed in doing things at a very high level, whatever it was. And so they passed that on to me. I had to work really hard in our business. I remember the first day when I came to McDonald's, I was 15, but my mother took me in the bathroom and she gave me a broom and a mop. And she said, "You need to learn how to do this better than anyone." She said, "You don't have to do it all the time, but you have to be the best. Because then when you ask anyone else to do it, they would have seen you doing it. And they know that you don't have a problem doing it." And what I tell a lot of entrepreneurs all the time, because a lot of people think coming into entrepreneurship, that means you get to kick back. It does not mean that. And these were life lessons that carried me to other companies, but the foundation of hospitality and service, and in particular food, will translate anywhere across any industry. So that's where I really learned hospitality, service, and great serving great food, and how to love people through food and great service.
I would love to talk a little bit about your pastry hands, because I think that there's something really particular about pastry recipes. I think that there's a way that we overlook how technically excellent you have to be sort of existing in the world of pastry, how those recipes aren't just something delicious that we consume. It's like so much work and love and time that goes into those kinds of recipes. So I would love to talk a little bit about your pastry hands, but also let's get into a little bit of good pudding, because I don't know that we know a lot of businesses that are preserving bread pudding the way you are. It's such an interesting choice in terms of the CPG world. To pick one that's so nostalgic and so particular, it seems an interesting choice. So I would love if you could just wax poetic a little bit about your pastry hands.
Okay, my pastry hands, we figured out very early on, and I would say that the beginning of pastry hands is that you just have cold hands. It serves you well not to have hot hands when working with pastry, especially if you're working like with a laminated dough where that butter has to remain layered between the dough. So laminated doughs, for those that don't know, is croissant, Danish. And so I wasn't using a sheeter. We were using hands. And so if you melt the fat, it's a totally different product. And so with the laminated dough. So I'm just good with pastry. I'm good. So it got to the point where my grandmother would make me make the crust. She'd be making peach cobbler, but I can make a darn good crust, because when I would break it up with my hands, and I had a way of flipping that where I could sheet that butter in that flour. And then when it comes together, I could make a really flaky dough. It's really an art. And I looked at it as, even when I'm making Thai dough, it's sculpted to me. You know what I'm saying? I take it very seriously. I know the difference between what kind of crumb is, what is the end result going to be based upon how I work that butter in there. And so it really is an art. And I love science anyway. I've always been drawn to science and chemistry. And the people that know and love me know that we say, are you in your lab? Because that's what it is for me. It's laboratory. I'm always testing. And now, of course, writing recipes and all of that. I just have a passion and a love for the art of baking and pastry. So how the bread pudding came along. Bread pudding was always a part of my life. It's an old Southern classic, right? My grandmother would make apple brown Betty or bread. Both of those are used with bread. It's basically leftover bread pudding is a peasant food. And so it would be whatever your leftover bread is, and you would make something. You're alchemists. And so we could take anything and make it something wonderful. Give us anything, we're gonna make it better. And so if it scraps, we're gonna make it out of sight. It's always been a part of me. Cobblers, all of that. Pudding, always been of interest to me, because puddings are not easy to make. When you start working with eggs and eggs can curdle. And so once again, it's a science. So when I was in culinary school, my final exam, I had to do an entire meal. I did a Creole meal, gumbo, because I'm making gumbo now. Gumbo and etouffee and crock and stuffed merlotons and all kind of stuff. And then my dessert was bread pudding. And some of my ingredients didn't come in and I had to wing it. And that became my recipe that I still use to this day. I used to sell it in a little restaurant called Miss Dossie's Fish Haven. My grandmother's nickname was Miss Dossie, and we opened this little restaurant in Decatur during the 96 Olympics here in Atlanta. And that bread pudding became so popular, people were driving all over just to get this bread pudding, to the point where my family said, maybe we should just do bread pudding. So that was in 1996, but I moved away, got married, life moves on. That took me back to Hollywood, and that's another story. So when I came back to Atlanta, January 2020, just before everything shut down, is when I decided to relaunch this product. So I renamed it. I actually didn't really have a name for it. I knew I would always market it at some point, and I decided now was the time. And so I decided to modernize the Southern Classic, and I said, how can I reimagine this in a new and fun way? And so I said, I'm going to make it in cupcake form, which was perfect. And so I named it Good Good Pudding. And then my girlfriend came up with the sauce. We call it Licky Licky Sauce. It's my original praline sauce that I've made for 30 years. This recipe, I told you, I'm a pastry chef. I'm a chocolatier. I do wedding cakes. I had a whole catering business. There's not one dessert that I cannot make. And everybody wants this bread pudding. And I shunned it, honestly, for a while, because I said, this is not sexy enough. I can do other things. And what I realized is it just makes people happy. This recipe is comforting. I think it takes people back to their childhood. It brings back memories. And so for me, it's about connecting to the soul. That's what soul food is all about anyway. I believe that they can taste the love. And they tell me that all the time. They can taste the difference. They know the difference. And I am very intentional about everything that I do. Everyone that's working with me is the same way. I believe my vibe is going to come through in my food. Southern cooks, they would say you put your foot in it and all those good things, right? Because we knew that meant you really put your essence into it.
I think that anybody who's listening should go over to your Instagram feed, because I think there's something really beautiful about when you have like your videos or just the imagery that you have. You have a video where you were making this peach sauce and you're talking about Georgia peaches, no fillers, like intentional ingredients. And I think that notion of that handcrafted, super specific, artisanal product that doesn't have to be fancy in terms of presentation, but is profoundly fancy in ingredient intention and just function. So let me just talk a little bit about the way you craft what you do, because it's just so interesting.
I love that. The way I approach food anyway is I love to keep it simple. And I think the reason why people are so drawn to the way I cook and the way I entertain or serve, because I did a lot of entertaining, is because I cook things very simply, but I use great ingredients. And we know that is the key. And I love for the ingredients just to speak for themselves. Because when you taste my peach cobbler sauce, that's not from a can. And I won't use a can. And I don't fault anyone for using a can. This is me. This is what I do. I have a high level of excellence. Quality is important to me. And I grew food. My mother and my grandmother always grew food. At least I grew tomatoes and some peppers and cabbage and lettuces and some staples. Always in the backyard or in containers. And I always did in California. I had an orchard when I lived in Orange County. And that's a whole other thing. I grew at least 24 variety of fruit. And so I believe in freshness and local in season. So I only make what's in season at the time. And this is our first year because we really just launched in March. So when peaches got in season, I was getting Georgia peaches and using Georgia peaches. This is quite a process to do that. But the difference is there's nothing like when people taste that, they're like, whoa, they know that there was effort here. They know that this is another level. And so we turned it into a sauce. I jar it and I call it fresh fruit sauces, but I don't use any thickeners. And so there's no flour slurry, there's no cornstarch in this. This is just cooked down, caramelized naturally, very few ingredients.
Being an active part of her community was a value instilled in Colette by her late mother. And now that she's back in Atlanta, she's on a mission to find interesting and unique ways to make her presence felt across the city.
When I was a teenager, my mother said, what are you going to do for the community around our business? My mother was amazing. She worked that community. She knew everyone in the community, from politicians to the people on the street. And she had everyone supporting her, that to the point where they said, don't steal from Miss Emma. You know, that's my mother's name. But she knew how to connect with people and connect with the community. And that's what she taught me to do. So she said, what are you going to do? So I think I may have been, they had been 19 or something. So I went to DeKalb Farmers Market. We know that the DeKalb Farmers Market is still there. And I asked them, I said, would you give me some fresh fruit and vegetables so I can take it into the schools and let them do tasting. I didn't even know what a tasting was at that time. It wasn't, we didn't hear about a tasting at that time. And that's what I did. I took star fruit and passion fruit and all these things into the inner city so that they could taste fresh. Even fresh apples were a big thing because they had never, these are food deserts, what we call food deserts now. We didn't have a name for it other than there was no fresh fruit or vegetables. And so that's still a part of what I plan to do. Within Giga Pudding and Giga Foods, we're going to be bringing that back because we still have the same issues within the inner city and we still don't have access to fresh food. And I'm also working with Choices for Kids. It's an organization that's been around for 18 or 19 years. And now I'm their resident chef and culinary educator. And I'm going to be doing some classes and they have a small herb garden over at Oak Hill, and we're going to be using those herbs in culinary and medicinal uses and teaching the community for free how to work with herbs. It's a big part of what I love. I just love fresh herbs. I use that in food in many ways because parsley is not just a garnish. I always say that parsley is not just a garnish. So I love fresh food, and that is it. And most of the time, I'm just using sea salt or pink Himalayan salt, and that's it. And people are like, oh my God, what is this? When it's quality, that's all you need. Sometimes it's a little bit of good salt. If you don't know how to cook, or if you don't have that, you got to do a whole lot of extra. But if you have great quality, I don't care if it's meat, vegetables, fruit, whatever it is, if it's good quality stuff, it's gonna shine through. The food is going to sing and it's going to speak for itself. I've been through a lot. But my attitude and my mindset, my gratitude, and let me tell you, when my parents passed, I had a very difficult time getting over that. I was down. I was depressed. I was stricken with grief. I got sick. But then I decided to honor them and live. They invested a lot in me. And now I embody all of that they are, and I'm just so filled with gratitude. And so good pudding, good food. This is my message. It's a good life.
We're taking a quick break, and when we come back, we're headed up to Richmond, Virginia, to chat with cake decorator and social entrepreneur Arlie Bell of Arlie Cakes. Keeping food traditions interesting for today's eaters can be tricky. But just as Talenti's founder turned traditionally made gelato into a modern day treat, aspiring chefs Byron Bradley and David Hargrove keep that same spirit alive with their food business, Two Brothers, One Love. The New Orleans-based duo serve up a modern spin on traditional Creole cuisine inspired by the bold, diverse flavors of Louisiana and the Caribbean. Follow Talenti on Instagram for more on Byron and David's business, along with other creators Talenti is championing within the Black culinary community. Welcome back to Black Desserts, a podcast presented by Black Food Folks. Our next guest is Arlie Bell, a talented baker and entrepreneur who, inspired by Paola Velez and the Bakers Against Racism movement, has created a practice that infuses her beautiful cakes with timely and socially relevant messages around politics, identity, and culture.
My name is Arlie Bell. I am a baker based in Richmond, Virginia. I run a business called Arlie Cakes. I am primarily a cottage bakery, meaning that I bake out of my own home. But I think also over the years, my business mission and purpose has morphed into, as much as I hate the cheesy word of community, but sort of like gathering people around issues of social justice through my baking and allow them to have social justice permeate all of the parts of their lives.
Richmond is a city that has always fascinated me. I first visited a few years ago for a festival called Fire, Flower, and Fork, and was taken by the city's reverence for history, as well as a strong community of independent, small food-based businesses. I wanted to know how working alongside that energy has influenced Arlie's practice.
Yeah, so I think of myself as relatively new to Richmond. So I moved here just over 4 years ago. I moved here from Charlottesville, Virginia to Richmond, which is just like an hour away. So I definitely feel like I'm still getting to know the food scene here. I was in Charlottesville for 10 years. So that was like, and I feel like that's also where I like did a lot of growing up too. I was very comfortable there and I moved to Richmond. And for me personally, I actually took a step back from baking when I moved here. And in the summer of 2020, I really wasn't pursuing baking work on my own. And in the summer of 2020, when everybody decided that Black Lives Matter and we should support Black businesses, I started getting all this attention and just like orders coming in that I like wasn't even looking for, and things just blossomed from there. So really, I feel like I was doing a few things here and there before that, but it's really just been in the last year that I have made running my own baking business more at the forefront of what I'm doing. But yeah, I get the sense that there is just a lot of opportunity in Richmond, which is really cool. Like a lot of alternative paths that you can take to be successful here. Coming from Charlottesville, I feel like there was just this cookie cutter version of what it meant to be successful and how to get there. And in Richmond, I just think there are so many different people doing interesting things and just wanting to support different people too. So that's been really cool to be a part of that. I love the community here.
You brought up a term that I love so much and I think we don't really lift up enough, is this idea around the cottage food industry. A lot of the way I see your work framed is the arts mission-based, community-based work, the messaging and intention behind your bake feels to me very much like Georgia Gilmore. It's that sort of, what can you do? What are your skill sets inherently? How can you use those talents to be effective in movement making, fundraising, physically feeding people? The power of your kitchen, especially in terms of baked goods, become massively important and have been throughout history. And so I love that kind of framing is central to how you are developing your business now. Talk to me about the challenges of cottage food businesses, because it's a really overlooked and underappreciated segment, but Black women, specifically people of color, have dominated and made the cottage food space viable in a time like this, and especially through COVID.
Yeah, it's just me doing Arley Cakes right now. My goal is to ultimately be able to hire people with a socially conscious practice. So morph into like more of a social enterprise and have that sort of impact. But right now it's just me. And I am also working a part-time job. And that, so like working out of my home kitchen where I have a deep freezer and a double oven. And that's about the only really special equipment that I have. So there are definitely like some space challenges and some time challenges. Sometimes I feel like people expect me to be like, I don't know, Panera or something. They like want to be able to like, I need a cake tomorrow and I'm going to come whenever I want to pick it up. That's like a big tension point for me, just like the expectations that people have on what I can produce and like how quickly. And yeah, like I'm not a big business. I'm really just a person, just like one human being doing all this. So yeah, it's definitely, there have been some growing pains, but I do feel like I've been able to grow into figuring out how to make problems not happen.
Not only is Arley a talented baker and cake decorator, but she seems to have a masterful command of social media. I remember seeing her cakes for the first time during the summer of 2020, when the Bakers Against Racism campaign was just beginning. Her Instagram feed is so well crafted. Her elegant yet evocative flower work and her distinctive handpipe script become powerful and subversive tools when she uses them to honor the lives of our murdered comrades or to simply remind us about the power of kindness, decency, and joy, even in the midst of protests and divisiveness. Her case became some of the viral images that made the movement resonate globally, and I wanted to give some room for Arley to talk about her approach to the artistry in her practice.
I would love to talk a little bit about your artistic practice. There's a definite attitude, a definite voice in your work, and that seems to be something that has been present the whole time, but it does seem to lock into a really particular kind of aesthetic right now, and I would love to talk a little bit about developing that.
Yeah, I've always been like a creatively inclined person. I was always into art and took a lot of art classes and stuff through all the way through college. Baking is like a creative outlet for me. But when I like making pretty things, but also when I'm like putting these messages, it is important to me that like I'm putting Black Lives Matter on a beautiful cake because I think that's a beautiful thing. And yeah, I want to be respectful of the issues and fights that I'm presenting. Like, I don't want to have some haphazard kind of ugly cake. Although sometimes I feel like I put too much pressure on myself. I don't know. I can be like very critical of the things that I do. But generally, I do like to put time and energy into making cakes really pretty. You know, when I'm like talking about things that affect me as a person, like as a Black woman in America, it is therapeutic to be like piping these beautiful flowers when we're going through another tragedy. And I get to create this thing that I present to the world. So that is a really healing process for me too, in some ways.
I just feel like there's like this way in which independent bakers, especially women of color, have been so creative and define themselves in these boutique businesses that have gone either direct to mail order, have been strategic in their partnerships with specialty brands, just these ways in which you can define yourself aesthetically, ethically, professionally, and then parlay into a whole lane that really doesn't exist quite yet, because not a lot of people in this space have that kind of forethought and clarity. And it seems, especially when just when I look at your work, there is this kind of alchemy to the way that Bakers Against Racism came into our consciousness. It was, in a lot of ways, reclaiming the bake sale for good. I think the bake sale in lots of communities have power. But when it came last summer, it just felt very much like, it felt like the civil rights era. It felt like George Gilmore. It felt like this really particular way of deputizing folk to use spaces they already existed in to be impactful and amplify that impact a lot further. You talked a little bit about how it's changed the practice over the last year and amplified it and made it something you really want to hold on to into the next iteration of your business. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that process in the beginning, how it's infused into your practice now.
Yeah, so I did participate in the first Bakers Against Racism bake sale. That was, I think that was in June of 2020. And that was also like around the time that like people were like, oh, who's Arlie Cakes? And I started getting more orders. So the first, I did a bake sale myself in July of 2020 for the 4th of July. I did the flag cake with some words on top that said to set the captives free. And part of the sales, so a portion of the sales, like I set a price for the cake, a portion of the sales, and then people could leave a tip for extra donation, like that all went towards an organization that provides bail bonds for people who are being detained by ICE. And that went really well. And it was also, it felt sustainable because like I said about the doing these pop-ups where I can set, this is how many I can make and not have that game of figuring out how much to make to sell. But also I wasn't just donating all of the money to this organization, like part of it did come back to me. And I did set it at a price so that it wouldn't be like a total loss for me, because grow a business, I have bills to pay. This, I want to support like important work going on, but I also have to support myself. So yeah, that went really well. And I've done other fundraisers since then. I've asked people on social media who follow me if they have any organizations that they think I should work with. I've done a little bit of crowdsourcing like elsewhere. Like I wanted to do a back to school one. So I went to the Facebook group for supporting Richmond Public Schools, because I don't just want to give to organizations that are like already within my network, especially since I feel like a lot of people that follow me on social media are like wealthy white woman. And I just feel like it could just be this echo chamber of like organizations run by wealthy white people helping like poor people of color.
Well, I also think that this, a really beautiful part of that is that now engaging with new communities that are, one, becoming aware of your work, but also people's investment in what you're doing is tenfold when this organization that they support or have brought to your attention, or can you hear me? It's just, it's not just expanding your business's reach, but also the awareness of organizations that, you, to your point, maybe don't have as many eyes on them as some others, and so are cross-pollinating awareness and attention for organizations in this really interesting way. There's something really just aesthetically beautiful about your work. There's just this artistic attitude around like every brushstroke, every sort of color choices even. But it does, it feels like, it feels accessible but luxurious. And I don't know if that's a weird balance.
That's the nicest thing anyone has ever said about my business.
It does. There's this way, like you just feel like if you got one of your cakes and had it on your buffet, or on, you gave it to someone for a birthday cake, or was at your wedding, it just feels right. It feels of the moment and modern in this way that I don't know that a lot of brands are able to capture.
Yeah, that's what I want my cakes to be special, and I want people to like be excited about them and to feel like special when they get them and to really enjoy it. But then I want people to enjoy it, and I feel like when stuff is too stuffy, it just feels like you're excluding a lot of people, and I want everyone to feel like they deserve my cake.
And that brings us to the end of Community Cakes, or episode 3 of Black Desserts. Hearing from Colette and Arlie makes me so proud that the legacy of so many Black bakers who have made movements and uplifted communities through baking is being carried on by such dedicated stewards. I hope that listening to their stories has inspired you to seek out the local bakers making an impact and putting passion into action in your area. I'd like to once again thank my guests, Chef Colette Knight and Arlie Bell, for joining me to talk about baking and community. You can follow Chef Colette on Instagram at goodgoodpudding. That's spelled G-U-D-G-U-D-P-U-D-I-N. And if you're in the Atlanta area, you can put an order for her delicious bread pudding by checking out her website, goodgoodpudding.com. Now, if you want to add a little dose of beauty to your social media feed, you can follow Arlie Bell's Baking Adventures on Instagram at arlie.cakes. And for those of you in the Richmond area, you can order Arlie's beautiful cakes at her website, arliecakes.com. Thank you for listening to another episode of Black Desserts. I'm your host, Trace Nelson, and if you're enjoying the series, I'd love if you could subscribe, rate, and comment on the episodes, wherever you're listening. We love to hear from you, and we value your feedback. Black Desserts is a limited series podcast presented by Clay Williams and Colleen Vincent, founders of Black Food Folks. The show is made possible by continued support of our sponsor, Talenti Gelato and Sorbetto. Black Desserts is produced by the brilliant creative team of Whetstone Media, led by founder Steven Satterfield, Season 2 producer Marvin Yu, editor Mary Creedon, intern Kyla Stone, and supervising producer Celine Glazer.